Welcome back to The Impact Room, a podcast hosted by me, Maisa Jalbout, and produced by Philanthropy H. In today's episode, we're taking a look at the social, economic, and geopolitical importance of water and how it can be used as both a weapon of war and a tool for peace.
As humanity's most precious global common good, water unites us all. And it flows across a number of global challenges. Water is about health, sanitation, hygiene, and disease prevention. Water is about peace. Water is about sustainable development, fighting poverty, supporting food systems, and creating jobs and prosperity. Water is about human rights and gender equality. That is why water needs to be at the center of the global political agenda. This means reinforcing water's place as a fundamental human right. It means designing and implementing a new global water information system to guide plans and priorities by 2030. And it means dramatic accelerating resources and investment into the ability of all countries to reach Sustainable Development Goal 6.
That was UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres addressing the 2023 UN Water Conference, the first of its kind for decades. A year on from that landmark event, what's really changed? And why do 2 billion people worldwide still lack access to clean drinking water? How worried should we be about groundwater contamination and scarcity? And how does water initiate or aggravate local, regional, and global conflicts? Joining me in the Impact Room to discuss these questions and more, we have Dr. Danilo Turk, the former president of Slovenia, a candidate for UN Secretary General in 2016, and a former chair for the Global High Level Panel on Water. Professor Mark Zaitoun, the director general of the Geneva Water Hub, and Dr. Mona Dajani, a fellow at the Geography and Environment Department at LSE, and an expert on community struggles around rights to water and land resources in Palestine and the occupied Syrian Golan Heights. Welcome to all three of you. It's my real pleasure to have you all together for this very important and timely conversation. Let's start with the issue of water scarcity. Where I'm sitting in the Middle East, this is becoming a major environmental and geopolitical risk. We know that countries like Jordan, Iraq, and Palestine, to name just a few, are literally running out of water. How concerned should we be about how water is being managed or mismanaged? What threat does this pose to community cohesion? Danilo, can I start with you, please?
Yes, water is one of the problems of the world that are underestimated, that are not very well understood, and that are not properly approached. Water scarcity obviously affects certain areas of the world more than others, and the Middle East is, of course, the most obvious example. And here, I think the need for a regional approach would be the most logical, but it doesn't exist. So what we have are a combination of national approaches and some bilateral cooperation, but clearly it is not adequate. And I would like to say also that the global situation does not help because, you know, even we don't think about current wars, which make things much more complicated. Even before that, we have seen fragmentation or fragmented international system. We have seen that some important basic issues such as global water cycle are not properly studied, and that water management is a general problem in the world. I mean, there is a lot of subsidizing and much less focus on water management. Even in water-rich countries, including my own, Slovenia, we have had serious problems with water scarcity in some areas, in some regions.
Mark, what are your thoughts?
Water problems are undervalued, and it's because, in part, we don't understand water well enough and the hydrological cycle. But in large part, also, I think it's because of the dominance of our political and economic systems that keep water really seen just as a commodity used to make profit or for military or political objectives. In terms of profit, basically, if you can produce food or electricity with water, those are really good things. It's clear from looking at places like the Dead Sea, the Nile, and Central Asia, we don't have the ability to stay within the sustainable limits of the resource, because as long as there is a profit to be made, then we'll pump out that water until it's just at or beyond its sustainable use, often not leaving much in the environment. And the politicians usually don't want to interfere with that system. Now, this creates an even bigger problem when that water crosses borders and leads to tensions between states.
Yeah, let's come to that in a minute. I just want to bring in Muna. Muna, what are you concerned about?
When I think of state of water at the moment, I think of it in a way of co-option. There is a lot of co-option in terms of certain hegemonic and dominant ideas and narratives around water keep us in this cycle of mismanagement, and a cycle of also relegating water to certain collectives or groups like nation states or a scientist or hydrologist, for example, and taking water away from the rest of society, the communities themselves who are stewards of that water, the role of culture here and heritage that can also contribute to a more effective water management and more sustainable and long-term solutions that communities feel empowered to engage with. So I think it's, for me, I feel, in addition, of course, to Danilo and Mark's interventions around what is the issue with water, I feel there is this co-option and this relegation of water to this realm of nation states, negotiations and techno-managerial solutions. And less attention is being on the role of communities and the responsibilities and the knowledge there that can contribute to better management, especially, as Mark mentioned, when it's transboundary water. Don't think of water scarcity as a natural condition, to normalize it and naturalize it in the Middle East, for example, without thinking of the possibilities of other ways of seeing and understanding and dealing with water.
That's a really important point, and I definitely want to come back to it. But let me just take you back to a point that I raised in my introduction, which is it's coming up to 1 year since the UN's landmark water conference. And I'm wondering, what has been achieved at that conference and since that conference? Has enough happened in terms of commitments? Mark, do you want to take it?
That was the first UN conference on water in almost 50 years, and a lot of us were expecting and hoping water would get the same attention that climate change gets, or even oceans, you know, because even oceans now has global agreements for sensible use and for cooperation around the globe. There were a lot of promises made, a lot of commitments, more than 800 commitments by states, NGOs, and companies, but I don't think any of those commitments were really significant to begin with, and few of them have actually been followed up on. So unfortunately, there was no aha moment. There was no change or pivot moment. What the conference showed me is that water use around the globe is and will remain out of control. I mean, states don't have this. The international system doesn't have it. Companies don't have it. Civil society doesn't have it. And so what that means is that it falls on all of us in the halls of power, in corporations, in civil society, to keep pushing. Progress is absolutely possible at the local level, if not quite at the global level so much, but we have to push at the global level as well. But more locally, I mean, you look at people like all these great lab scientists in Gaza who were doing groundbreaking work on antimicrobial resistance in water and wastewater from hospitals, like Dr. Reem Abu Shomar, or people like Hummat al-Dijla Association, working to save rivers in the Tigris in Iraq, who are risking their lives to make things better for everyone, really. And so that's what the UN conference has taught me. It's up to all of us to continue to act individually and locally, as well as realize that we have to continue to push at the global level, even if it's not working out as well as I would like it to.
It sounds like it was a good start, but insufficient. Is that correct?
I would say it's definitely well-intended, but for very specific reasons, largely to do with politics, I'd say it didn't achieve what it was meant to do, but it's part of a process. And I'll pass over to Danilo because I'd like his thoughts on this.
Yes, I'd just like to add to Mark's analysis and conclusions, with which I agree. One has to understand the state of the United Nations and international community in general. Mar del Plata conference some 47 years ago, which was the only major conference on water in UN history, was prepared very well, was technically well prepared, and that led to a concept which is critical for policy making, concept of integrated water management. But that integrated water management is a concept that applies to nation states. They are the ones who are expected, who have technical possibility and obligations to ensure integrated water management. Now, nothing like this exists in the preparation for the last year's water conference of the United Nations. There was no conceptual framework which would be sufficiently powerful to guide policymaking in the future, either nationally, regionally, or internationally. So the conclusion was all right. Even the Secretary General didn't prepare a report for the conference. It was done through, a variety of contributions. And the outcome was what Marx explained, or like 800 commitments. And obviously, that shows the fragmented nature of the international community when it comes to water, but also more generally. And the interesting thing is that after the conference, there was quite a bit of analytical work on those commitments. And it was found that only 28% of those commitments have a clear source of funding, and that only 22% of those commitments have quantitative targets for outcomes. The outcome, I would say, consists of good positive aspirations, a variety of commitments which are not very strong, and a lack of platform or a conceptual framework which would guide activities for the future.
And Danilo, I mean, obviously political divisions at the global level have a significant impact on all international issues, but in terms of water, what kind of impact does that have in terms of the way water is used or abused? And can you give us examples of how that's playing out?
You see, divisions in the world are partly those that we see everywhere, but partly they relate to questions of major actors, should I say countries with significant water programs, who do not see a global framework as helpful and would prefer to work on water issues either nationally or bilaterally. There are quite a few countries that major players who see it that way, and that prevents a more general, more global approach to emerge. But then again, let us not put all our bets into the global arena and the United Nations and organizations like that. Much has to be done and can be done at local levels and through a variety of initiatives.
Are there any examples that you'd like to share?
There are positive examples that should inspire. I keep mentioning on occasions like this the Senegal River Cooperation Arrangement, the OMVS, Organisation de Mise en œuvre du Fleuve de Sénégal, which is an organization, international organization with legal personality, its capacity to also taking loans and financing programs on the river, which involve four countries, Senegal, Mali, and Mauritania. These countries have demonstrated that it is possible to work in a regional system, but that was because they had very wise leaders at the right time who were able to see, to realize how important their cooperation would be, and have established a system that by now, after about half a century, works pretty well. So, I mean, that's a more recent example. And of course, there are examples from the past that can be quoted from Europe, but, they are historical. They took a long time to emerge. And one should understand the difficulty, or let's say the political obstacles that slow down such cooperation. In the Balkans, we have the cooperation on one of the rivers, which is very good, but that is because of flooding, which is a problem everywhere. And, you know, countries realize that in order to have efficient action, they have to cooperate. I mean, there are examples, the Guarani aquifer example in Latin America and so forth. But, you know, they are a result of specific circumstances and political wisdom of people who were able to push for such cooperation.
Muna, can I come to you now and ask you about how water is being weaponized and used as a tool in conflicts around the world? Can you give listeners an idea of what that weaponization looks like in different contexts and what kind of impact it has?
I think it's a big topic that that needs to be addressed, especially when we speak about water in the Middle East. I think hegemonic ideas around, you know, the scarcity, for example, condition of water there necessitates and kind of pushes for a certain way of seeing the world we live in. And weaponization is another one like that. Weaponization of water happens when water becomes used as a tool to exert collective punishment over certain communities, or water to be used as a weapon in war. So direct, you know, demolition actions towards vital water infrastructure, like we see now in the case of the besieged Gaza Strip and the ongoing onslaught that is happening. This deliberate and direct attack is actually weaponizing water access and water infrastructure for political reasons and as a form of collective punishment over populations. And water also weaponization happens when water is used also as a tool to hinder progress in negotiations as well over political reasons as well. And I wanted to say that I see water weaponization also happening against individuals. So when water is weaponized in a way to force communities to be internally displaced, for example, if we speak about the occupied West Bank, and we see that communities in Area C of the West Bank, which is under Israeli military and administrative control, are being pushed by way of using water as a tool to push them out of their communities, to push them out of their land and replace them with illegal settlements and to, you know, reduce Palestinian presence in those areas. So this is another form where water is used as a tool to displace and dispossess. So in addition to the clear, you know, direct violence against water infrastructure and water systems, we also find that water is being weaponized here on the very basic level of deprivation of that water. So it's not due to water scarcity, and this is kind of going back to the point I mentioned earlier, is usually when we speak about the West Bank, for example, and we speak about Palestinians not having enough water, it's not due to natural phenomena specifically, it's actually a very man-made condition, with water at the heart of that weaponization being used by Israel as an occupying force against occupied groups.
Mark, is there anything you'd like to add to what Muna just said?
Yeah, I think Muna made a lot of really good points, especially the point that these issues are usually made by humans, which is good news, because we can't blame climate change or God or Mother Nature for everything. We created the problem, means we can fix it. But look, even Leonardo da Vinci had suggested diverting the Arno River to win a war. The Belgian troops did this against the German invaders in the First World War. Russia is doing it in Ukraine today. Snipers set up in Beirut or Sarajevo to hunt women down who would go and collect water, like thirsty gazelles, as Mahmoud Darwish says. So water has always been used for military objectives, but what we're seeing in Gaza is at a scale that's sort of beyond the pale, to a point where the basic conditions of life now are being challenged. And I think that has some serious consequences, most notably and very predictably for the people in Gaza. So of course, the reverberating effects of whether it's intentional or not, but damage to water and wastewater systems means the water and sewage mix and microbes can transmit. So the diseases like dysentery, especially in Gaza, can spread quite rapidly under these conditions, especially if people are malnourished and crammed together, which is exactly the conditions that are available now. And so that's what we're seeing, especially harmful to children, toddlers, because they don't have the immunity to resist this, and they die of dehydration and diarrhea, basically. But it's also a problem, I'd say, to use water as a weapon more generally, because, you know, if it's done in one place, then it's going to be done in another place. And very quickly, and I think we're already at that point, water, which we claim is a source of life, becomes a source of death, in fact. And so the actual, you know, the life-preserving, life-giving elements of water, you know, cleansing and nourishing elements of water are totally perverted if we continue as an international community to allow politicians to use it for political ends, like ethnic cleansing, or militaries to use it for military ends with all these predictable and disastrous conflicts. I'm personally not against the use of water as a commodity. I think the commodification of water is not in of itself a problem, because we use water for peaceful ends, or at least we try to dissolve tensions through water. And there are a lot of examples like that. But it certainly, the commodification of water is a problem if you're using it to achieve military ends. I mean, if we're going to insist on killing people, let's use weapons or stop the killing in the first place.
Mark and Muna, you paint an absolutely chilling picture, I think one that should alarm everyone around the world. I'm wondering if we can now just shift to what are some of the positives that are happening. Sticking with you, Mark, Iraq recently became the first Arab country to join the UN Water Convention. How significant do you think this is? Is this a positive step, and what difference will that make?
Great question. Definitely a positive step, because the UN Water Courses Convention, which is one big element of international water law, sets out exactly how states should share their waters. It's based on what states have done in the past. It's customary law. It says, for example, that states should use the water in an equitable and reasonable manner. So that's a suggested way to allocate water between countries. Because it's based on how states have done it in the past, it means that it's a very sensible way of reconciling the differences between upstreamers who want to use the water and downstreamers who are affected when upstreamers use the water. That's international law. So it's definitely a positive step. Now, Iraq is downstream on the Tigris and the Euphrates. Actually, it would be helpful to imagine yourself being downstream in Basra, the very end of the Tigris and Euphrates after they join, and look upstream, and you'll see dams all along the Tigris and Euphrates in Iraq, in Syria, all the way up in Turkey, plus on all the tributaries of the Tigris in Iran. And so all of these dams are uncoordinated. And basically, every single dam is holding back as much water as it can, or using the water at the rate that it wants to if it's producing electricity. And so southern Iraq is literally drying up. Southern Iraq today is what Egypt fears to become because of the dam being built upstream in Ethiopia. Iraq is already there. It's not getting the same attention as on the Nile. And so here the question is, can international law, Iraq's accession to the UN Convention, UNECE Convention, bring about a change in that situation? Will it mean coordination amongst all those dams upstream and across four different countries in a neighborhood where, frankly, right now, each and every one of those countries is bombing different targets in the other countries? And the answer is clearly no. I think we're asking too much of law at that point. I mean, law won't trump the bigger political and military objectives here. But this is a long game. You know, if Europe is cooperating over rivers today, it didn't look this way 60, 70 years ago when people were trying to eliminate each other and the rivers were all polluted. It remains a sensible thing to create these river basin organizations like Danilo talked about, and where Western Africa is leading the world, to think beyond sovereignty, beyond your political borders, because water spans those political borders. And so it's not fashionable, but international law is one component of the right way forward. And I think, you know, if it's part of a negotiation strategy that also wants to consider climate resilience and links issues like dust storms and the effects of climate change, which are wreaking havoc for the farmers throughout Iran, Syria, and even in Turkey, then it becomes an issue of common interest. And law alongside aligning of interests, possibly sharing of benefits, that has to be the way forward. Because the only other way forward is violence. The tensions are really high there. A lot of people in southern Iraq are forced to move into the cities, and we know where that leads us.
If I may add one thing here, you see, international law is an expression of fundamental need. And obviously, it's usually a very general expression and one that requires a lot of work on implementation. But it has to be understood in its comprehensiveness. Marx spoke about the principle of rational, reasonable use of water resources. Now, there is another fundamental principle involved here in the international water law, and that is the principle of do not do significant harm. And I think that that question of significant harm has to be approached seriously. It is usually not approached seriously. It's usually approached politically when the downstream country complains about something that is happening upstream. But of course, it has to be taken seriously by all involved. And do no significant harm should be really in the forefront of any discussion on transboundary water, which is obviously a necessary policy because much of surface water is shared by countries. So when it comes to places like Iraq, obviously the upstream countries have to think about doing no significant harm. Now, they would usually say, well, you know, we are doing our best, but the downstream country is not using the technical capacity or sufficiently sophisticated methods for using water and is wasting water. But that argument is not a final word. I mean, one would have to then continue that discussion and say, all right, I mean, these are the practices which may constitute significant harm, and if so, should be mitigated by some, and so forth. So you see, a debate on these issues have to take into account all aspects and has to be pursued in a very serious and responsible manner.
Mona, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this.
I feel this gap, like this growing gap between the decision makers and their way of interpreting international law, for example, trying to make it more utilized, let's say, or like negotiated in a way between those countries. And then can we think of, you know, the everyday user, the farmer, who is trying to make sense of those very contradicting policies that their governments put in place. And this is, I just wanted to raise a point that this is where, you know, we need to kind of also make sure that these discussions and debates that are shaping water policy, how can we translate it to the everyday discussions and even in our education? Because I think this is, for me, as a water researcher, I always struggle with that, because we are talking about it at this level of, you know, how do we make sure that countries are coming together to address these issues? But then we know that communities don't know even about all of these discussions, all of this world that we are working on. People are not aware of how it actually works materially. So people don't know what the transboundary water body is. People don't know what these arrangements are, the responsibility to do no harm, and the upstream, downstream, even dynamics are very distant from the everyday practices of acquiring and managing and dealing with water.
Danilo, can I ask you to answer that?
Well, briefly, and Mark will probably be able to say much more on this, I would say, well, there is no substitute for action. I mean, you know, the communities which are affected by water problems have to organize, and there is, I think, no escape from that. I know that this is not something that yields results quickly. From my own country, Slovenia, which is water rich and which doesn't have dramatic problems, but where the voices of local communities and local needs are not heard, and it takes a major crisis before something starts to move. We have had this sort of situation in the last 2 years. I don't see any substitute for community action, for organization of affected people, and for NGO support that could give voice to those people. Successes exist, unfortunately not much in the region of the Middle East, but in other parts of the world, successes do exist, in Europe, in Latin America, in West Africa. So I think that that's the way to go.
One of the things that we try to do on this podcast is to give this information to listeners who are quite keen to have an impact and engage on these very complex issues. on the issue of water, obviously NGOs, philanthropists, people who work in this space more broadly could, as you just mentioned, Danilo, have a more significant role. However, let's hear your views. I mean, where can these entities, these grassroots organizations, who often are not well-resourced and don't have enough leverage to voice their concerns, to engage, how can they play a more significant role? Mark or Muna, can I hand that to you?
Yeah, thanks, Mesa. It's a great question because, of course, the easiest thing to do, what everyone thinks about is when you think about water and how do you support it, is that classic image, the photo op of, you know, after you dig a few wells and you get a picture of a very happy African kid with a big wet smile. Or if it's linked to climate change, you know, there's always these images of turbaned Arabs or Fulani people standing with forlorn looks on dried and cracking ground and with the suggestion that you should, you know, irrigate this system more efficiently. I mean, that's important and it's really important for those people, but you're replacing what the state should do for those people and substituting it in the short term. And you're also, you know, subject to the white savior complex. It has that kind of savior mentality written all over it. So I think that the longer term game is supporting all those people who are making water work, for lack of a better way of putting it, for peace in a very encompassing term. So, you know, scientists toiling away, pushing the limits of, you know, water quality. Even some of the water quality that people in Europe drink is not safe. It's not even tested for something. So scientists like the ones in Gaza who are doing the work on antimicrobial resistance have to be supported. Labs have to be rebuilt. Activists who risk their lives or get kidnapped when they're trying to save their rivers, or they're at least risking their careers, right? Because, of course, the development banks would never hire them. They need support and they should be given support. Lawyers who are doing the work building campaigns, often in dirty, hot rooms under ceiling fans, challenging the system and using law for justice, which is another old-fashioned word, which I think we shouldn't lose sight of. And then, of course, the diplomats. And here I use the term generally. Anyone who's trying to change the game through nonviolent ways, I would say, is a diplomat. And many of us are playing the long game, building relations, trying to turn things around internally, while others are working externally. You know, states and development banks aren't going to support these kinds of initiatives, but philanthropists who are more into higher risk, higher reward, interdisciplinary types of investments, I think have a niche to fill here. I'm curious what Mona has to say.
I really feel strongly about it as well, because whenever also we're calling out to philanthropists or trying to kind of frame the issue of water, we just automatically think of what can we build to alleviate water issues. But now, knowingly, you know, throughout this conversation, we have heard, you know, how political water is and how sometimes very disattached it is from us, from people and communities, societies who are dealing with water on a daily level. So I think one thing is that, first of all, is to go beyond, you know, building and addressing symptoms of an inherent problem in the framing of water issues. So I think this is really important. So the idea is not just to alleviate the symptoms that we see of like mismanagement of water, the fact that water is unequally available for certain population, like in Palestine, for example, where you see that the problem is not about, you know, building more infrastructure to alleviate water suffering or to increase water availability. It's an inherently political issue. It has to do with justice. It has to do with these very important concepts that cannot be quantified very much easily. And it's not about just using water justice as a frame by these international bodies. It also has to do a lot with reclaiming, you know, rights of people to their resources. So I feel, yes, moving beyond, you know, a building of certain infrastructure and considering it again. And I think one other thing is that, you know, working with NGOs as well is that ideas, especially in the Middle East in general, we have authoritarian regime. So they are actually dictating the rules of the game, between quotes, kind of, you know, they are presenting these communities in these international forums, but they don't really have that authority to do so, and they don't work for the common good of the community. So I think in terms of like what can be done is NGOs need to not work also on a basis of of what is expected from them, from this international forums and the blueprint solutions that these international forums come out with. But actually, it has to be the other way around, where communities are at the forefront of it. And where water is actually, we reclaim, you know, water as a right of communities, you know, and we also acknowledge that communities have a lot to give. So it's not the idea of like helping communities gain more water. Actually, water is there in different capacities, different volumes, but water is around us. It's in everything we do. But the whole idea around it is not to focus on water itself, but focus on the relations with water. You know, how can communities, how can civil society, how can activists, how can artists, scientists, everyone be working towards a common goal, which is achieving, you know, water justice for our own sake, you know, for our community's sake. Because as long as we deal with water in this transactional and very commodified way, water problems will remain and intensify also under climate change. So I feel what needs to be done is to kind of give the forefront and the center stage for people to reclaim what we think about water. How do we value water and how do we want to manage it best, and not leave it all at relegated and leave it for, you know, the dominant actors, the same actors that have been doing that for decades. And as we see, the results are not really looking very promising for the future.
Mark, is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Yeah, I just wanted to end on a positive note. I don't think there's any reason to be naively optimistic, but not to be defeatist either. I mean, there are a lot of examples of fair and equitable and sensible water use out there. A lot of them come from Africa. And there is a lot of cool technology that helps with this. And so long as we keep that political dimension central, we'll get there eventually. We're not going to give up, and we shall not give up. And in the meantime, remember why we're working in this for all the people who don't have the same privilege of having fresh and clean water 24/7.
Danilo, is there anything else that you'd like to add to that point?
A few months ago, an interesting bank was established, really, the International Water Bank. And it is now at the beginning of its work, trying to get the right kind of projects to be financed. There is some basic capital available. And it would be interesting to see if there are projects perhaps arising from the circle of participants of this discussion today that could be submitted to the bank for financing. I'm prepared to work on this myself in the coming months. What kind of project would you like to suggest for financing to an international water bank? We can continue on that basis, and then of course I will make my best to help ensuring that funding is available. I cannot promise success. What I can promise is to do my best. Thank you.
Danilo, Mark, and Mona, thank you all for joining me in the Impact Room today. We'll share links to the reports, research, and organizations you've mentioned in our show notes. I'm Maisa Jalboud, and you've been listening to The Impact Room, a podcast produced by Philanthropy H. Follow us on social media at Maisa Jalboud and at Philanthropy H. And please don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. Until next time.